So, since we women are usually right, why are we still stuck in the Dark Ages? Because we don't feel like we're right. Well, if we are right, why don't we feel like it? Because we are waiting for permission. Now, you will notice that my career began to slide after the king had been crowned and I started needing his permission. Before that, nothing could stop me in my voices. But after I started waiting for permission, I lost my timing, I lost my momentum, and finally I lost my confidence.
Author and actor Carolyn Gage. Her website is carolyngage.com. That's CarolynGage, carolyngage.com. Tune in next week for more of The Second Coming of Joan of Arc. Special thanks to CJSF-FM and to your local radio station, to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, editor of Il Dono, The Gift. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden, and this is Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'd like to welcome you to this latest episode of American Standoff on KBOO. And this is a show where we examine the current political divide in America from an Indigenous perspective, given by myself, Jacqueline Keeler, a Native journalist based here in Oregon. And so I always started by reminding everyone that we started this show exactly a year to the day after the January 6, 2021 storming of the U.S. Capitol. And so this is sort of always sort of frames the coverage that we're doing. And so we've been covering a lot the last few weeks, the House Select Committee January 6th hearings on the insurrection. But today we're going to actually take an international sort of look and discuss the Pope's recent visit to Canada. You know, Pope Francis has been visiting Canada this past week, and he is returning a visit to the Vatican that was made by representatives from First Nations and Métis communities, nations in Canada, to the Vatican, in which they basically sought healing and some sort of recognition of the harm caused by the Catholic Church through running residential schools in Canada. And residential schools are sort of what we call boarding schools, Indian boarding schools here in the United States, and many boarding schools in the U.S. were also run by the Catholic Church, and we'll discuss that a bit more later in the show. The reason we're looking at this is because one of the things I bring up over and over again on this show is the doctrine of discovery, right? And I've mentioned it many times, and we're going to go into a kind of a deeper dive into the doctrine of discovery and how the Catholic Church, particularly the Pope, the office of the Pope, is directly responsible for the legal sort of rationale between the dispossession of native nations of their own land. And so we're going to have more detail on that as well. So please do join us. Call in. This is a call-in show. The number here is 503-231-8187. Many of you may have heard of a doctrine of discovery, you know, or you may have been seeing coverage of the Pope's visit to Canada. You know, go ahead and tell me how you feel about it and what you feel about what you saw. His visit is to, he's coming, he was asked to come to Canada to apologize in person, and he is doing that now. He actually visited a First Nations community in Canada and to apologize for the trauma and harm to thousands of Native children by the Catholic Church in these residential schools. And so using the framework of the doctrine of discovery, we'll discuss that while this is appreciated by some, there is a strong call for structural change in the political relationship between occupying colonial governments and Native nations, and of course the fallout of this unequal relationship of power. This power relationship is that Native children are not protected, and Native people are subjected to violence, so we'll go into more detail on the legal ramifications of the Pope's, of papal bulls in the past, and how that's led to the situation we presently endure today, and how these papal bulls that were issued in the 15th century are the bedrock of colonial claims to ownership of Native land, and have led to the formulation of the doctrine of discovery by one of the early chief justices of the Supreme Court, John Marshall. It's because of these two papal bulls that were issued by the Vatican in the 15th century and signed by those popes that there have been calls by Native people and organizations for the Pope to reject the doctrine and to use his position to call upon colonial governments, the U.S. and Canada, from using this as a legal argument for their domination of other nations' homelands. Many organizations have called for the renunciation of the doctrine of discovery. Particularly the National Congress of American Indians, which I linked to in the description of this show, has issued a very detailed call to the Pope and how they would like to see this happen. And you can read that on our webpage. Let's go ahead and play some opening audio of some news coverage, a short little clip here, kind of going over the Pope's visit.
Go north to Canada, where Pope Francis is visiting on what the Vatican is calling a penitential pilgrimage. He's there to apologize for the abuse of Indigenous children in Catholic-run residential schools, a dark chapter in Canada's history that made global headlines after hundreds of unmarked graves were found at residential schools last year. Take a listen to some of what the Pope said today.
I have come to your native lands to tell you in person of my sorrow, to implore God's forgiveness, healing, and reconciliation, to express my closeness and to pray with you and for you.
Well, that apology has been a long time coming, as our Paula Newton reports.
It is a papal trip like no other, one that will see Pope Francis humble himself on behalf of the Catholic Church and apologize to Canada's Indigenous peoples for years of abuse and harm. Only months ago, few could imagine his journey here, one the Pope is calling a journey of penance. for what a Canadian National Commission says was cultural genocide. At least 150,000 Indigenous children separated from their families and forced to attend residential institutions where thousands endured physical, sexual, and emotional abuse from priests, nuns, and school staff.
Kneel down the way you made us kneel down as little kids and ask for that forgiveness.
Victoria McIntosh was taken from her family at the age of 4.
My grands made this for me.
This was the coat she says she wore when her mom dropped her off at a Catholic institution in Manitoba in the 1960s.
That nun took it off of me and threw it at my mom.
McIntosh said the nun then called her mother a savage, an incident she said foreshadowed years of abuse. She says her mother never forgave herself.
And I told her, I said, it's not your fault. It wasn't your fault. What choice did you have?
McIntosh says she was sexually assaulted by a priest for years when she was only a child.
He violated me in ways that no child should ever go through. And I would break down and I would cry thinking about it, what he'd done. And I wonder why. What did I do to you?
McIntosh says that priest was 92-year-old Arthur Massey. It was only in June when he was charged with indecent assault. He has not entered a plea. And it is the impunity of the Catholic Church's actions that hangs over this visit. Even as dozens of Indigenous communities now search the grounds of these institutions, where hundreds of unmarked graves have already been identified. As Indigenous communities work to recover their lost children, there is still much ambivalence about the Pope's visit and his apology.
The Pope was blunt. He called it a journey of penance.
I don't know. That's interesting interpretation of it, right? You know, for me, it's not a journey, right? It was more than a journey for our people, I think. And the journey will never end, right? It's going to be there forever.
Pope Francis says he acknowledges that, but hopes this historic gesture of atonement will bring some measure of relief and healing.
So there, you heard a bit of the coverage from CNN about the recent visit of the Pope and his apology to First Nation and Métis survivors of residential schools called Indian boarding schools here in the States, and for the horrors they suffered as children. The question is this sufficient to cleanse the Catholic Church of its role in the dispossession and genocide of Native peoples? Which I mentioned before, via these papal bulls that were issued by the Vatican, and which I will begin to go into a lot more detail about how that led to the Doctrine of Discovery. Once again, good morning. This is American Standoff, and this is a live talk radio show, so please feel free to call in. Have you heard about the Pope's visits? How do you feel about, do you think this is enough, or do you think more is needed? And what do you know about the Doctrine of Discovery? I'd be really curious to hear what you have to say. So you can call into the studio and be part of this conversation. The number here is 503-231-8187, and I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host. So I also like to open the show by greeting, saying hello in my own language, and also recognizing the Native nations whose lands Portland is located on. And so I say Jacqueline Keeler. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. In the Navajo way, we introduce ourselves through our clans. My clan is Kia'ani Mishle, and I am born for the Yankton Sioux people. My father's people are the Hankthalon Dakota people. And I'd also like to acknowledge that what we now call Portland, Oregon, is located on the ancestral lands of the Multnomah, Wasco, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Cowlitz, bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Cayapuja, Malala, and many other tribes. And the question I ask every episode, as you all know, who are regular listeners, of every episode of American Standoff is that in the more than a year and a half now that has passed since January 6, 2021, when we all saw the U.S. Capitol storm, what have we learned, right? And so Today, in this episode, we're looking at the Pope's apology for the deplorable evil, as he called it, of Canadian Indigenous schools. And he was on July 25th, 3 days ago, he was at Mascouches, Alberta, Canada, and he was there not in his Pope mobile, but in a wheelchair and in a arbor where many tribal folks have community events like powwows, things like that. And it was sort of, to me, really very different from the Vatican, where he was very much enthroned in this, you know, sumptuous palace. Here he was on the prairie meeting with, and it was a select group, was basically just survivors. So they were elderly people who were survivors of these residential schools. And so it was pretty extraordinary in a way. I never thought I'd see that happen, you know, and you know, he was there to, he called their forced assimilation a deplorable evil and disastrous error. So, and so he, the that part of Alberta where he was at, it's near the site of two former schools, and he apologized for Christian support of the colonizing mentality of the times and called for a serious investigation of the schools to help survivors and descendants heal. I should note that the Catholic Church has been very obstructionist in dealing with this issue in Canada and in the United States as well. And it's also refused to release records that could help prove the cases or even verify what students were attending. So there's a lot that could be, a lot more that could be done. So with shame, he said, this is quoting quoting Pope Francis, "With shame and unambiguously, I humbly beg forgiveness for the evil committed by so many Christians against the Indigenous peoples." And this was you know, quite a moment, honestly. And there was a bit of controversy because he was given a eagle feather headdress and an Indian name, I think White Eagle, and this was seen as not appropriate by many Indigenous people I've heard, both in Canada and the United States. Because these eagle feather headdresses are given to leaders, mostly leaders in war, right? And he is not a military leader, and it didn't seem to many Native people, it didn't seem appropriate to give him this honor, and so that was a bit controversial, as I mentioned earlier. Part of the issue that many Native people are looking at, and I mentioned the National Congress American Indians resolution, they're requesting the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope to denunciate the doctrine of discovery. I think they meant denunciate. Yeah, and so the National Congress American Indians issued this resolution. Let's see a date on it. In 2022, the mid-year conference. So that, in case you don't know, the National Congress of Native American Indians was established in 1944. It's the oldest and largest national organization of American Indian, Alaska Native tribal governments. And so in the resolution, they cite the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, UNDRIP, which affirms that all doctrines, policies, and practices based on advocating superiority of peoples or individuals on the basis of national origin or racial, religious, ethnic, or cultural differences are racist, scientifically false, legally invalid, morally condemnable, and socially unjust. And so this is a call to the Pope, the NCA calls upon His Holiness Pope Francis to acknowledge and atone for the historic injustices done with complicity along with other foreign economic and political forces, and to explicitly denounce and condemn the doctrine of discovery as a basis for the violations and abuses of the individual and collective human rights of the Indigenous peoples of North America. And so we're going to discuss a bit today the doctrine of discovery. And I've mentioned it before in the past, and how it basically underlays the claims the United States government has to our homeland, right? And it's based on the United States being a Christian government. This papal bull was basically only applicable to sovereigns that were acknowledged the Pope as their leader. And at the time, England did do that in the 15th century. And it directly is tied to the U.S.'s status as a colony, as a British colony, an inheritor of the status of England, and as formerly under the Pope at the time the papal bulls were issued in the 1400s. And so I'm going to, I thought we could play a bit of audio of a lecture. I'm playing a couple of lectures on the Doctrine of Discovery given by Bob Miller, who was a professor. He used to be at Lewis and Clark Law School here in Portland. He is now at ASU in Tempe, Arizona. I'll let him describe a bit about the Doctrine of Discovery. Play part one of Bob Miller's Doctrine of Discovery. It's the third audio clip.
The United States Supreme Court decided in Johnson v. McIntosh that North America was settled by the English primarily under the doctrine of discovery and conquest. What did that mean for native peoples, for the indigenous peoples of North America? Well, the court said they immediately lost some of the rights to their land. Magically, without any consent, without any consultation, without any payment, or even without knowledge of indigenous peoples, they lost the full ownership of their land under Anglo-American or English and American property law. What else did the Doctrine of Discovery do to indigenous peoples? Well, they immediately lost, again, without their knowledge or their consent or any agreement with these Europeans that showed up, they immediately and magically lost some of their sovereign powers. The right, according to the United States Supreme Court, to engage in international diplomacy and international trade were the two primary examples the court talks about. So somehow, just because Europeans showed up with their flag and their cross and planted it in the soil, they were making a legal claim. And I want you to remember, the Doctrine of Discovery is about law. In fact, the Doctrine of Discovery is probably the first form of international law that was developed. Gosh, what is international law? Well, it's the agreements that the international community develops how governments will interact with governments. That's really a good definition even today of international law. So how did these European countries decide among themselves to divide up the world? Boy, that's pretty nice. Steve, you and I ought to define how to divide someone's house out here. So if you and I can just agree on it, then we can, you know, take your property. Wow. What a unique thing. But this case has been enormously important. It's been cited dozens and dozens and dozens of times by the courts in Canada, by the courts in Australia, by the courts in New Zealand. It's even been cited three times by what's called the English Privy Council, which is the highest Supreme Court in the United Kingdom in England. Always cited about colonization and the power of the white, non-indigenous government to control the indigenous peoples. I'm not going to explain that opinion anymore because we just don't have time. What I'm going to explain to you briefly are the 10 elements that I, after reading Johnson v. McIntosh 50 times, these are the justifications, the 10 elements that make up, I think, the doctrine, the international law doctrine of discovery. First, and this was primarily developed by the Catholic Church and by Spain and Portugal. starting in the 1340s, primarily being solidified in 1436, when Pope Eugenius II issued, I believe, the first papal bull about actual colonization and European power outside of Europe, granted the Canary Islands to Portugal to control and convert the wild men, that's quote unquote, the wild men of the Canary Islands. The Canary Island peoples were denigrated by the Spanish and the Portuguese. You can read the identical definitions of what were said about American Indians and the indigenous peoples around the rest of the world by Spain and Portugal. Why these Canary Island people have no law, they have no agriculture, they have no clothes, they have no money, they don't speak our language, they don't have laws. Well, the vast majority of those things were lies, weren't they? But those were the same kind of justifications that have always been described about American Indians and indigenous peoples elsewhere. To lower, literally, folks, that's one of the elements of racism, of the definition of racism, is to somehow set yourself apart from the other, and then to lower in your valuation the way they live, or their law, or their ethics. And that's exactly what the Spanish and the Portuguese were doing. Boy, I'm going to need...
Okay, so that was a bit of Bob Miller's presentation. One of his, we'll play another clip from another presentation he gave from here in Oregon at the Oregon Historical Society as well. But to kind of briefly go over sort of his points that he was making, and I apologize that was a little quiet, but the Doctrine of Discovery is a concept of public international law that was that legitimized the colonization of lands outside Europe. And it really started with in 1452 with Pope Nicholas the Fish issuing a papal bull authorizing Portugal to conquer non-Christians and consign them to, quote, perpetual servitude, right? And then further popes issued bulls expanding that right to subjugate non-European peoples. In 1493, Pope Alexander VI issued the Bulls of Donation, justifying Spain's claims to lands visited by Christopher Columbus in his expeditions of 1492 and later. And then, of course, to resolve some of their conflicts, Portugal and Spain negotiated a treaty to basically sort of divide up non-Christian lands and how they would be colonized under the Doctrine of Discovery. And then this answers U.S. law, right? We'll be getting fairly early. He's going to go more in the next clip. He's going to talk a bit about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, how they understood and utilized the Doctrine of Discovery. But in 1792, as Secretary of State, Jefferson claimed that the European Doctrine of Discovery was international law. And as you heard in that clip, Bob Miller saying that this was the beginning of international law. It started with these papal bulls splitting up the world to European colonial powers, and that this is applicable to the U.S. government as well, right? And so there are three main decisions the Supreme Court issued early on in the 1820s and 1830s that are called the Marshall Trilogy, and these are the bedrock of Indian federal law in this country. Supreme Court Justice John Marshall, right, Chief Justice, he issued a decision in 1823 called Johnson versus McIntosh, which basically laid out how the colonial powers laid claim to lands and to belonging to Native nations, and that only the discovering nation can have fee simple title to the land. And that has been used as recently as 2005 in the case of Sherrill versus Oneida Nation, and which I mentioned many times was actually the decision was the majority decision was actually written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and although I understand she later regretted that. But that is just to show that that is still the active law of the land. It's how the U.S. makes claim to the territory it claims, right? And so the direct line between the Pope the office of the Pope and the colonization and the genocide and the trauma of Native children in these residential schools and in the taking of our land and destruction of our cultures. It's a direct line. It's not like he's kind. It's a direct line of responsibility. And so, I think I've briefly described Johnson and McIntosh in previous episodes of My American Standoff. But just to revisit it, there were two plaintiffs. The plaintiff was Mr. Johnson, who inherited land. His grandfather had purchased the land directly from the tribal nation, the Piankashaw Nation, and meanwhile, the defendant McIntosh came along later, and he purchased the land from the United States government, and the tribe had also sold some of the land to Lord Dunsmuir, Royal Governor of Virginia. So in that way, the U.S. was sort of claiming it. And so the decision went to basically McIntosh because the tribes could not convey title directly to an individual. They could only sell the land to a colonizing power that had had the right of preemption, right? Who all the other European colonizing nations recognized as having the right. And so I think in the longer bit of that lecture, Bob Miller goes into a lot of kind of hilarious descriptions about how this is why, you know, you come and you see, you know, all these explorers coming and putting their flag, you know, in the soil and reading out a little thing, you know, kind of it's all part of the legal sort of the legal rigmarole that goes to claiming other people's land and making it yours, right? And it still sort of plays out today. There's some more recent issues, like with the Northwest Passage in Canada, whether the U.S. is saying that's actually sort of international waters, but Canada is saying no, it's ours because it's opening up because of climate change. There are issues around, you know, making claims to you know, even the moon and other, you know, putting our flag there. These are all actually part of this legal history. The 10 points that Bob Miller was talking about, he has the 10 elements that he thinks constitutes a doctrine and are useful, he thinks, in analyzing and comparing how settler colonizer societies have used this international law against indigenous peoples. And you should definitely check out Bob Miller's book, Native America, Discovered and Conquered, Thomas Jefferson, Lewis Clark, and Manifest Destiny. And the number one element is first discovery, right? The first European country to discover lands unknown to other Europeans claimed property and sovereign rights over the lands and native peoples. But to complete the title, you also have to do the second element, which is actual occupancy and current possession. So to basically turn it into recognized title, a European country would actually have to occupy and possess newly found lands. And so this was done usually by building forts or settlements. He makes a really great point that, you know, how often Lewis and Clark, when they were heading out across the country, they wouldn't stay with the tribes. They like when they were staying with the Mandans, they didn't stay in their comfortable roundhouses that were, you know, much warmer. They went and built their own rickety fort, right? And this was part of the process of establishing the dominion of the United States and ownership of the land as they were going across the country. And then when they came here to Oregon, you know, they built that fort rather than staying in the more comfortable longhouses of the local tribes because they were establishing that right. And so their ownership.
We have a caller.
Okay. Hello? Caller?
Oops, they hung up. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Please do call back in. Yeah, I'd be very interested in hearing what folks think of this. I understand that many people are already familiar with this, so I'd love to hear what you have to add. And the building of these forts and settlements had to be done within a reasonable time after first discovery to complete the title. The third element is what I mentioned earlier, preemption, which is discovering European countries also claim the power of preemption, which is the sole right to buy the land from the indigenous peoples. So, this is basically a monopoly, right? A monopoly on the right to the exclusive option to purchase land, which then obviously reduces the value of the land if you can only sell to one seller. And Bob Miller talks about how, in his book, about how, you know, Jefferson knew this, and he kind of bragged about it, like, oh, we can pay them 5 cents an acre and then sell it for $2 an acre, right? And actually this sale of Indian land really underwrote the finances of the U.S. government in the early years, because so otherwise they would have been bankrupt, right? And they knew they had a monopoly, and that the system would play in their favor, this doctrine of discovery. And and the U.S. still claims this power over Indian lands today. And so the fourth element is Indian or native title. So even though European legal systems claim that indigenous peoples and nations had lost their full property rights and full ownership of the lands, that we only retained, we did retain a right, which is the right to occupy and of occupation and use, which is the same right that animals have. Yes, definitely not viewed as this Indian title, or as they call New Zealand Maori title, is not really the title accorded to human beings. Okay, so there is in the basic notion of how the U.S. owns the land and other colonizing country, settler colonial countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, there is in these notions that they don't believe that the indigenous people are actually human, fully human, right? And so, and this is still the law of the land. This is the law of the land of the country you live in, that you are a citizen of, that you own title through. This is the source of your title to your house, to your property. And it's based on the idea that Native people are not human. And this goes straight back to these papal bulls issued by various popes in the 15th century. The fifth element is tribal limited sovereign and commercial rights. The sixth is contiguity. They wanted, basically European countries wanted their settlements to be, you know, contiguous to each other. Some of this played a role in Louisiana Territory and Oregon country as well. They would claim, they would start at the mouth of the river, and then they would claim the entire watershed, which I think I've described before. I think here in the Columbia River, the Bostonian fur trader, Mr. Captain Gray, he went and he named the Columbia River after his boat, the Columbia, and this was part of laying U.S. title to the land. And it's all around us how this doctrine of discovery works and has built our reality today. The seventh element is terra nullius. The eighth is, which is the idea that the land was void or empty. This was particularly used in Australia, and that the land was vacant, right? Even though there were, of course, millions of Aboriginals in Australia at the time. And the eighth element is Christianity. Religion was a significant aspect of the doctrine of discovery. Under discovery, non-Christian peoples were not deemed to have the same rights to land, sovereignty, and self-determination as Christians. And this was, some people will actually trace this doctrine of discovery back to the early what are those called? Where they were in trying to, you know, get the Crusades, basically, and going into Islamic held territories. And but others trace it directly to the 15th century. Civilization, the ninth element is civilization, European ideals of civilization, and were very important parts of discovery and ideas of superiority. So Europeans thought that God had directed them to bring civilized ways and education and religion to indigenous peoples and to exercise paternalism and guardianship powers over them. And this is still expressed in the way Native nations are treated. You know, I mentioned the Navajo Nation has a land base the size of Ireland, but all of that land is held in trust, right? Because we're in a wardship relationship with the U.S. government, right? We're still under tutelage to civilization, right? And so the person who, of course, now Deb Holland, who is a Laguna Pueblo tribal member, is the Secretary of the Interior, which oversees these lands. So we do have a Native woman in the federal colonial government that is actually the head of the heading up this trust relationship, which is interesting. But I don't know. So that's a different development on that. But we still don't have our lands in fee simple title, and it cannot sell or even develop lands without the permission of the federal government, right, of the U.S. government. And the 10th is conquest, the 10th element. This element claimed that Europeans could acquire Indian title by military victories in just and necessary wars. I put both of those in quotation marks. In addition, conquest was also used as a term of art to describe the property rights Europeans claimed to have acquired automatically over indigenous nations just by showing up and making a first discovery. So they don't even have to actually engage in warfare with the tribes. Just by appearing on the coastline, they have basically implicitly subjugated the native people and taken their land. So this is a so this doctrine is a doctrine that is very useful to maintaining colonial power and presence, and it is the legal rationale for the U.S. today, and so this is sort of it's been cited many times, and the term in another one of the Marshall trilogy is the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, which was decided in 1831 by the Marshall Court, and it supported the concept that tribes were not independent states but quote domestic dependent nations, and that's where that legal term comes from, that all federally recognized tribes are domestic dependent nations. And this played out even into the 20th century with Oliphant versus Suquamish Indian tribe in 79 and Duro versus Reyna in 90, which used the doctrine to prohibit tribes from criminally prosecuting non-Indians. And so that is part of what leaves Native women particularly so vulnerable to violence on their own lands on the reservation, because the tribes do not have criminal jurisdiction over people who are not enrolled in a federally recognized tribe, which means that it's up to the federal government to prosecute them. And I think the latest figures show that the federal government declines to prosecute 70% of the time. So that means a lot of violence that occurs against Native people on their own land is not prosecuted. And so, so this is the ways in which in addition to the harm and the trauma caused by residential schools, that this is an expression, I think, of the power dynamics between sovereign between Native nations and colonizers, right? And that still play out to this day and are still embedded in an intrinsic part of the legal structure that we all live in today. So this is what they're asking the Pope to address, and in addition to actually meaningful financial help with helping Native people recover, Native families intergenerationally recover from the trauma that has happened with the sexual abuse and the physical abuse and the loss of language. This is also an issue here in the U.S. As I mentioned, Native American. I shared an article recently on my social media. If you follow me on Twitter or Facebook, it's an article that came out recently from Reuters, and it's all about. You can look up hashtag Nine Little Girls, and it's all about survivors of Mardi Catholic School, which was a Catholic school on my dad's reservation, on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, survivors first started coming forward and discussing what had happened to them there. So I grew up hearing about this stuff fairly young, and it's very traumatic to hear what happened, and it's something that stays with you, that once you hear it, you can't forget it. And I'm not going to retell those stories here on the radio, but you can Google Mardi Indian School and survivors, and you can read these things. And they've been published in newspapers, articles, probably since the 80s. So there's quite a bit of this been published on them. But in May, the U.S. government did acknowledge the damage inflicted by boarding schools, and but as far as but to try to get some sort of a justice for the survivors of Marty, the Catholic school at Marty, I think it was called St. Paul's Indian Mission School in Marty, South Dakota. It's now called Marty Indian School, which is why I keep trying to call it that. It's run by my dad's tribe now. No, it's no longer run by the Catholic Church, but it used to be called St. Paul's Indian Mission School in Marty, South Dakota, and which is right in the middle of the Yankton Sioux Reservation. But unfortunately, a South Dakota state law bars victims of alleged sexual abuse age 40 or older from filing civil lawsuits against any institution that knew or should have known about it. And so this basically was amended and shortened the statute of limitations for victims to seek damages. And it basically protects the Catholic Church in South Dakota, and whose priests and nuns ran St. Paul's and four other schools in South Dakota. And so these survivors are, of course, getting elderly. They're dying off. And one quote here from one of the survivors, her name is Geraldine Charbonneau Dubort. She's from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa tribe in North Dakota. And she says that she quoted in the article saying that she's 73 years old, that the South Dakota legislators are simply waiting for the rest of us to die, right? And but she's going to keep fighting. And you can read more about her struggle and what she's trying to do. You can search for the hashtag #9littlegirls. She was abused sexually by priests and nuns, and when she arrived as a 6-year-old, and it escalated into rape, which occurred multiple times. And at 16, she was actually impregnated by a priest and forced to undergo an abortion, according to her deposition in her 2008 civil lawsuit. She and her sisters sued 4 priests, 6 nuns, and 2 school workers, all now deceased, whom they alleged took part in the abuse. It was run by the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, the Oblate Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, and Blue Cloud Abbey, and they've all denied wrongdoing. So this is something that is happening here in the U.S. as well. And of course the Catholic Church has not been very helpful in addressing this issue. And the apology, I think, given by the Pope, by Pope Francis, did not include actions by the Church in the United States, just Canada, right? And the Canadians are much farther along in this issue. They've gone through a truth and reconciliation process. They have had financial settlements done by the government to survivors, all things that have not happened here in the United States. They've been working at this for many decades now, and I can tell you that the impact of this abuse is felt still by these families, these Catholic Indian families today, and so because it becomes intergenerational, I think I've mentioned this before. Oh gosh, we're almost to the end. So let's actually get to the second audio. I didn't realize it was so late. I apologize. Let's get to the second piece of Bob Miller talking about the doctrine of discovery.
Purchase from France of its rights in the areas you're going through. And he now told him, he said, now you can more directly propose to the Indians that they engage in commerce with us. You can now tell them we are their new fathers. The Spanish and the French are gone, never to return. And look at this line. So he tells, and this again shows that Jefferson understood tribal rights, the doctrine of discovery, and rights in land. So he says, being now become sovereigns of the country. So he's talking about the U.S. This purchase from France had given the USA sovereign power, some limited sovereignty over the indigenous peoples. So we're the sovereigns of the country, but it's still subject to Indian rights of occupancy. Okay, if I beat you over the head enough, Jefferson knew what the doctrine of discovery was. He used it like every day in his job as Secretary of State, when he had to write legal opinions to the Congress and to the President, and when he was a governor of Virginia, and when he was a congressman and vice president and president.
Okay, it appears like I didn't get the entire audio there. I actually meant to begin with he was talking about George Washington, and because both Washington and Jefferson had, they understood the doctrine of discovery. Even 30 years before it was articulated, or even 40 years before it was articulated by Chief Justice Marshall. And so George Washington made this statement to Congress in 1783. He said that Indians retreat as our settlements advance upon them, and they will be ready to sell as we are to buy. Because Congress at the time was actually considering, like, just pushing out all the Indians. And I've gone through in episodes of this show of American Standoff, and in my book Standoff, I actually look at the ways in which the Revolutionary War was fought in order to gain access to Indian land. It was very successful in that because, of course, King George III had issued the Proclamation Line of 1763, which I believe actually caused the Revolutionary War. It was part of the settlement of the French and Indian War, which basically confined the British colonists to the coast. They could not cross the Appalachian Mountains, but everything west of the Appalachian Mountains was Indian reservations, was Indian land. They could not go in there. And so... So now they've won. Now they have the right to push all the Indians out, and basically take the land, right? So he goes on to say, settlement of the Western country, and this is George Washington, and making a peace with the Indians are so analogous that there can be no definition of the one without involving considerations of the other. Policy and economy point very strongly to the expediency of being upon good terms with the Indians and the propriety of purchasing their lands, in quote, and this is underlined, preference to attempting to drive them by force of arms out of their country, which, as we have already experienced, is like driving the wild beasts of the forest, which will return as soon as the pursuit is at an end and fall perhaps on those that are left there. When the gradual extension of our settlements will as certainly cause, and this is also underlined, the savage as the wolf to retire, both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape. In a word, there is nothing to be obtained by it anymore but the soil they live on, and this can be had by purchase at less expense. So he's talking about using the preemption in the Doctrine of Discovery to then have the, you know, because they can only sell to the U.S. government. They can't sell to anyone else. And so they can then buy the land cheaply, and then as more and more settlers come in, then they can just push them out. And this is basically what happened, right? And then he's talking about Jefferson and Jefferson's knowledge of the Doctrine of Discovery and how this informed. As early as when he was Secretary of State, it was supposed to be in the audio clip, I'm sorry, but he was bringing up as early, as the 1790s with the British ambassador, and basically saying that you cannot go there anymore. These are our Indians. We are the only ones who have the right to deal with them. And talking about the area that is called the Northwest Territories, and which included, the Ohio Valley, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, I think Minnesota as well, like five states around the Great Lakes. And so that basically, and this was so once again, they had fought, they'd gotten access to New York State and created, got rid of the Iroquois Confederacy, which had been there for 1,000 years, and where they were, so they were basically becoming, you know, taking land and selling it, and so this was very profitable. And so just that quote, that audio clip was supposed to show the way in which both Washington and Jefferson were very aware, and it's also played into the Louisiana Purchase as well. What they purchased from France was not the land, but they purchased the preemption right, and then they had to go and negotiate with the tribes individually. And so that was but the preemption right based on the doctrine of discovery. And this is the instructions he gave to Meriwether Lewis, who was also his personal secretary and lived with him in the White House for a couple years before he went on this journey. And so they were very aware of the legal sort of things they had to do to be able to make, to sustain the U.S.'s claim. And so, I think we're almost to the end here. I want to play the last audio here, and maybe, and also encourage any callers to call in if you'd like to be part of this discussion. Our last audio is talking about is the second part of the CNN coverage, which had a really great interview with a survivor, which I would like to play.
Andrew, a survivor of a Catholic-run residential school. Paul, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Paul, I hope you don't mind. I'd like to begin with your story. First and foremost, how did you end up going to one of these residential schools?
Well, I was 8 years old, and I remember my mom taking me down to the beach. In those days, we just had a plane coming in on floats. And she was crying, and there was three of us. And we didn't want to go, obviously. We didn't know what was going on. And then we got on the plane. I don't remember the first year I spent in residential school. And I was 8 years old. And then later on, I went back. I was in my teenage years. And it wasn't so bad. But the residential schools was very difficult because of a militaristic atmosphere, the abuse that the report was talking about. And you know, times like this, I remember my teammates, my roommates, my classmates, and all the other people. There was a lot of people that obviously did not make it home. So I think a lot about those things, those people that did not make it home. And I struggled through my years. I did well in my work, but for a long time I lost the language. I lost the stories and songs and everything about who I was. It was a very difficult time for a long time.
It has been described as cultural genocide. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I definitely agree with that. And I'm hoping that the Pope would acknowledge that in his apology there would be a genocide in there. Essentially, I think a lot of people agree that the church gave colonizers permission to do what they did. And so one of the things that I certainly felt myself is that when I spoke my language, they would definitely strap me. They would definitely hit me because of those kind of things. And I know other students were the same thing. And that the policy of the Canadian government, and the Prime Minister apologized for this, was he said we had a policy to kill the Indian in the child. So it was the church who were responsible for carrying out that policy. So nowadays, they did not necessarily kill the Indian in the child, but they left some very wounded, deeply, deeply wounded children that are still struggling. I'm in my 70s. And I'm still struggling from that. And when I see something like this and people talk about their experiences, a lot of my own experiences come back to me.
Would you be willing to share one of your hardest experiences that stays with you and that has left you scarred and struggling?
One of the things that sexual abuse does is that it severs any kind of relationship that you have with people. Hmm. And we as Indigenous people live on the land, and we believe that we are connected to everything. Our relationship is based on all those connections. We have certain responsibilities that goes with those connections. and we have connections with the immediate family, and the circle gets wider. What has happened with sexual abuse particularly is that it severed those relationships. And when you're a young child, you don't realize that. You begin to think that this new way of relationship is the way to do that. Mm. It's okay to hit people. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be hateful, because those are the kind of things that came up to my mind. And I think that was difficult to really go through, because the people that I come from are loving. They're very, very careful to take care of the young people as well as anybody else. There's a lot of unconditional love. There's harmony within the community, not only with the elders and other youth, but also the environment, like I said. And all of that got connected. So when the residential school was over and I went back to the community, I couldn't fit in the non-Indigenous world, and I couldn't fit in my own world. And one of the things that I know is that a lot of my teammates, my classmates, my roommates say the same thing, is that we're just in the middle of two cultures that we did not know how to deal with.
Sort of suspended in air almost. I've talked to several First Nations people about this, and they always say that they feel this shame, but the shame should be on the adults and the institutions that perpetrated this on you. I want to read you what Pope Francis said, a very striking apology. He said, "Sorry for the ways in which, regrettably, many Christians supported the colonizing mentality of the powers that oppress the
indigenous people." We're almost at the end of the show. I just wanted to add, we could pause that to add one last thing. So I wanted to end the show by quoting the Honorable Murray Sinclair. He is First Nations and a former senator and chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. And he stated that in addressing the Pope's apology to survivors, he said, "Despite this historic apology, the Holy Father's statement has left a deep hole in the acknowledgement of the full role of the church in the residential school system by placing blame on individual members of the church. It is essential to underscore that the church was not just an agent of the state, nor simply a participant in government policy, but was a lead co-author of the darkest chapters in the history of this land. Driven by the doctrine of discovery and other church beliefs and doctrines, Catholic leaders not only enabled the government